Let's get started. That may be, test it towards the right level. Just a couple of announcements. I believe this Friday, tomorrow, may be the last day to add or drop courses, and I got some ominous notice from the administration, a little softer maybe, that if you don't do it on time, I was astounded. I think it said $200 fine. Some big fine if you don't do it on time, and I was supposed to warn you of these dire consequences. So be duly warned, whatever you're supposed to do. I think it's having to do with add or dropping courses. Be sure you do it, I think, by tomorrow. Okay, just a couple of words about the reading next week. The reading from Issues in Science and Religion by Ian Barber is a really dense reading in some ways. It's a fairly old piece. It's about 20 years old, but I think remains, in my judgment, one of the best brief introductions to scientific method and some of the ways that this ties in with the humanities. Judgments that we make in morality and so on. But some of you are going to find the reading reasonably difficult. It's not terribly long, fairly dense, and you may have to read it a couple of different times. My experience is that it probably is one of the most useful readings that we assign during this course, because a surprising number of undergraduate students, and to my dismay, even a surprising number of PhD students, have never done much thinking about science in a philosophical manner and how scientific judgments relate to judgments we make in ordinary life and in ethics and so on. And in that sense, it's an extraordinarily valuable reading, well worth you're spending some time on. What I'll probably do in this case, as I will do two or three times later in the semester, is I'll probably take a class period and give a kind of running commentary on the reading, either before sections or possibly after. It works well both ways, to unpack some of the sections in a little more depth. And I found that having almost a recitation period, a kind of running commentary on the reading, is fairly useful and helps you get into the material better. But don't be dismayed if you find some of that reading difficult at first. It's well worth the struggle that it will take. Maybe a little too early to say it, but do make an effort to get to class on time, because with the one entrance, the side entrance, it's quite annoying in a way if we lose the first 5 minutes or so. So make the best effort you can to be here on time. I realize sometimes professors don't let you out on time, and that's a difficult one, and I will try to make sure this class ends on time. We've been talking about the meaning of the term nature, and I tried in the last class to have you look at some fundamentally different ways in which we use the term. Nature as wilderness, and on the other hand, nature as a synonym for cosmos, world, or universe. And I pointed out that because these two meanings are not kept distinct, there is often a kind of semantic slippage between these two fundamental usages that makes comments about nature sometimes really quite incoherent. Nature as cosmos is not an empirical reality at all. It's not something we can perceive or deal with empirically. It's an intellectual construct. It's a heuristic framework that we have devised. And indeed, virtually all cultures, as I reminded you, have a similar framework, often presented in rather mythological terms, that help them integrate and understand and come to grips with all the individual experiences they have in the actual world. But when we use the term nature as synonymous with cosmos as all that is, at least if you're a philosophical materialist, if you're an atheist, nature becomes all that is, but at other times use it as referring to wilderness as over against culture or civilization, we get into real problems because our comments become really quite incoherent. And that's why if you, say, are a philosophical materialist and believe that nature is all that is, then obviously you can understand humans fully within the category nature, although it already becomes a little bit difficult to use terms then like artificial or unnatural. If you're a theist, then it doesn't make sense to claim that you can understand humans fully within the category nature. Now, I also referred briefly to the fact that both within the ancient Greek culture, among the Ionian Greek philosophers, and among the ancient Hebrews, you had a rather dramatic pulling away from nature. So-called primitive peoples viewed almost all of their lives in terms of the conflicts among the gods and goddesses, and participation in the religious cult was seen as a really necessary part of life, almost as we would view going to the doctor for medical help, because participation in the cult was what helped the seasons change, helped grant fertility to your animals and to humans, and so on. But you had roughly in the 5th, 6th century BC, some hints even earlier than that, you had among the Ionian Greek philosophers an attempt to understand the world about us, not mainly in terms of conflicts and tensions and the actions of the gods, but as explainable by earth, air, fire, and water would be one formulation, as explainable by physical causes. And this shift, this almost demythologizing or desacralizing of nature, was, in a sense, necessary for the development of modern science. Now, modern science, as we know it, didn't develop for a long time afterwards. And one of the reasons is that in the ancient Greek culture, they had a cyclical view of time. Time was a kind of endless repetition, a kind of great wheel that turned around. Different philosophers had speculated on different periods. Where among the ancient Hebrews, you had the emergence of a linear view of time. Time as having a beginning, as progressing, and even as coming to a kind of final climax. And it was the conjunction, in many ways, of the rational tools developed by the ancient Greeks with the biblical sense of linear time and the biblical sense of providence, the biblical sense that the world is orderly. When those come together, at least it provides a greater likelihood that we will have the development of modern science. Now, as I also suggested, to a large extent, human history has been a pulling away from nature, in part simply to survive, in large part. As I pointed out, nature will kill you. It will succeed in killing you. Probably will kill me somewhat sooner than you, at least looking at it statistically. And much of human history has been a trying to escape the inexorable fate that history places upon us, to provide food and shelter, a development of medicine. And as we look around us today, I'm sure in a class this size, there are 3 or 4, maybe 5 or 10 of you who would not be here at all, maybe more, apart from modern medicine. Our lives today, to a considerable degree, represent a pulling away from the chanciness and the inexorable working out of natural law and deliberately changing these to our own advantage. Culture, in many respects, is in tension with nature. The desacralizing of nature the demythologizing of nature has, I think, both benefits and liabilities. And I'd like briefly this morning to refer to some of them. As long as nature was seen as pervaded with divinity, every tree and mountain and river and stream and animal pervaded with a spirit and divinity, it was psychologically, I think, much more difficult to engage in the kind of activities we think of as modern science, to objectify the world about us. And there was, as the Frankfurts explained, essentially a subject-subject relationship to nature rather than a subject-object relationship. As nature was desacralized or demythologized, I think psychologically it became more nearly possible to distance yourself from nature, to objectify and analyze nature. And this, of course, I think was one of the preconditions for the development of modern science as we know it. In the second place, desacralized or demythologized nature presented the basis of a new social dynamic. Nature religions tended to be religions of the status quo. They tended to be essentially very conservative. Life was tied in very closely to the annual cycles of nature, to planting and harvest, to birth and death, and so on. And humans were embedded in this this whole world of nature and the annual cycles in a way that is quite different from the way we think of life today. And by contrast, what you have with the changes in Greek philosophy, and in some ways even more so in ancient Hebrew religion, you have the possibility of a new social dynamic that emerges as human beings think of themselves as, in some sense, distinct from nature. Let me tell you a story that nicely illustrates this. It's from the Jewish scriptures, from 2 Samuel chapter 11. I'll read the first paragraph and then tell the story. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go forth to battle, David, that is King David, sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained in Jerusalem. And then follows an incredibly interesting story, one which, tragically, very few people even know today, although it's one of the constitutive stories, one of the paradigmatic stories of Western culture. The story continues that while Joab is off fighting the Ammonites, besieging the city of Rabbah, King David remains in Jerusalem. Nothing unusual about that. He had things to do, and Joab was a very able commander. But as the story develops, it mentions that one day as the king was walking on the roof of the palace, he looks out and sees a very, very beautiful woman bathing in the garden, and Bathsheba. And he desires her sexually and sends a servant to fetch her and bring her to the palace. And he has sexual relations with her. And unfortunately, as the story develops, she becomes pregnant. And this causes a problem because her husband, Uriah, is off with the army, with Joab, fighting, while the king is sporting with his wife back in Jerusalem. Uriah the Hittite, he wasn't even an Israelite. He was a Hittite, a resident alien in Jerusalem, but a loyal person who wanted to support the king and the army. And the king knows that Uriah is off with the army, and so he's somewhat unsure what to do. But he sends a message to Joab, and he says, don't you think Uriah's been working pretty hard? He's been very brave and loyal, and maybe he could use a few weeks off. is a kind of reward for his faithfulness, especially considering that he's not even an Israelite. I use the term Israelite, incidentally, deliberately, because the terms Jew and Judaism don't come into common usage till about the 6th century before the present era. And so he sends a message to Joab, give him some time off. He deserves it. He needs a break. So Uriah is pleased to have a little vacation. He comes back to Jerusalem. But instead of going to his own house, he goes up to the palace and stays in the palace. This was in part because of the code of war at this time involved an abstinence from sexual relations before the battle, during the battle, and for some time afterwards, not because of antipathy towards sex. The issue was much more complicated than that. So Uriah, even though he's a foreigner, a resident alien, observes this code of war and refuses to have sexual relations with his wife. The king urges him to maybe not be so scrupulous and spend some time with his wife, have a good time, and he resolutely says no. Here are my colleagues off fighting the battle, and why should I be breaking the code, and this just doesn't look good. And so David is frustrating. His hope, of course, was that he would have sex with his wife, not keep very close track of the time, and think the baby that was coming was his own. Well, he didn't do that, so this presents somewhat of a problem for the king. So he decides to send a sealed message with Uriah back to Joab, the commander, which says, arrange for Uriah to be at the very center of the battle, right at the front of what's going on, and then on a prearranged signal, pull back all the supporting troops. Not a nice arrangement. They do this, and of course, Uriah is killed. Now, in many ancient civilizations or cultures at the time, that would have been the end of the story. In fact, it's not even clear the story would have gotten that far, because in many ancient societies, the king had almost absolute power and would not even necessarily have been that troubled about the situation to begin with. But it wasn't the end of the story in ancient Israel, because sometime after that, it's not clear just how long, Nathan, a prophet in Israel, who knew the king well, comes up to the palace and tells King David he wants to talk with him, has something important to share with him. King David says, okay, what's on your mind? Nathan says, I'm really bothered about something very badly. He says, there's a family here living near Jerusalem, an extremely poor family. But they're good people. They work hard. They've been good, loyal citizens. They had just one little ewe lamb. That's all they had for cattle and so on. And they loved this lamb. They even let it sleep in the house at night, and the kids played with this little ewe lamb. But then a wealthy neighbor who had large flocks came and stole this little lamb to serve it to some guests he had because he didn't want to kill one of his own lambs. And Nathan asked the king, he said, what should we do about this? What should we do with this man? And King David is very angry, very upset about this. And he says, this just never should take place in Israel. We'll make him pay back at least threefold, fourfold. And then in one of the great moments of Western culture, a moment tragically almost unknown, because it's not presented in our schools much, one of the great moments of Western culture, Nathan the prophet looks King David in the eye and says, you are the man. You are the man. How did he have the nerve to do that? He had the nerve to do that because Nathan the prophet knew that David the king knew that Uriah, even as a foreigner, even as a resident alien, was under the covenant protection of God, and that this action was fundamentally unjust. And Nathan knew that he could take this risk because King David knew this. It was still a risk, but he took the risk. And the story ends that David repented of his wickedness and so on. Now, this is one of the great moments in Western culture because it reflects some of the early stages of the passionate commitment Jews have had through the centuries to justice. And this commitment to justice is rooted in part in the understanding that we are not simply creatures of nature, totally determined by genes and environment. We're not robots. We are people who possess at least a degree of freedom, who can say yes and no, who can choose to act like King David or choose not to act that way, and that this justice is rooted not in the exigencies and transitoriness and so on of nature, but it's rooted in a transcendent God. This is a different tactic, but similar to what Plato, Socrates, Aristotle did. Aristotle rooted his concepts of justice also in the transcendent realm, the realm of eternal forms or ideas, the ideas of the good, the beautiful, and the true. And what is at stake here? And it's an issue of critical importance in some ways for those of us who have been too deeply immersed in evolutionary biology, for instance. I'm not opposing evolution here. I'm just opposing some of the wrong philosophical conclusions that often are based on evolution. Human beings, in my judgment, are not simply robots. We're not simply blood chemistry and physics and biology. There is something inherent in human beings that asks questions about fairness, about justice, about how we ought to live with each other. And interestingly, these questions historically emerged, and I think philosophically, in a sense, can only be well grounded if we are not simply creatures of nature. Animals are creatures of nature. They don't ask philosophical and religious questions as far as we know. We don't morally exhort our dogs and cats, except partly in jest, and we don't any more than we exhort our cars and our elevators and so on. Human beings, it seems to me, however this emerged, through God's design and creation, through evolution, however this has emerged, and maybe those two are not so different, maybe God works through evolution, human beings have separated themselves from nature, at least to the extent that they experience the moral imperative and are deeply committed to asking questions of justice, seeing things like slavery and various forms of discrimination and economic oppression and sexual oppression and so on as unjust, and as are having the possibility of doing something about this. And this story is significant because this reflects the belief that is emerging now, already fairly well developed by the time of King David, of God as a transcendent God who is not just the God of the ancient Israelites, but is the God of the resident alien as well, and a God who guarantees justice. And as I've suggested, that tactic or that tack that is taken is very, very similar, functionally similar, it's very different in some ways, to the tack that Socrates, Plato, Aristotle take in arguing about justice in a more philosophical sense. So the pulling away from nature opens up the possibility of culture. In fact, in a certain sense, they're synonymous. Animals are fully embedded in nature. Animals don't develop culture in the way humans do. So the dream of going back to nature, fully immersing ourselves in nature, in a way, I think, is a threat to our humanity. And I'm not here in any way putting down the importance of nature, the importance of preserving wilderness, the importance of spending time in nature. All of these, I think, can be beautiful and healing and salutary for us as human beings. But somehow the idea that if we could revert back to the life of the noble savage, we would be more fully human, I think is largely a myth, and in the sense even of a myth that is not true. Because the very experience of being human involves to a considerable degree the development of culture, the pulling away from nature, the development of our rational and moral powers, reflections about questions of justice, and how we relate to each other. But this is a dangerous freedom. This is not altogether a positive development. Because desacralized or demythologized nature can easily become brutalized nature. Once some of the psychological inhibitions are weakened, once we no longer see nature as pervaded with spirit, we, I think, psychologically are in a position where it's easier for us to brutalize, to exploit, to dominate nature in a very negative way. Incidentally, we don't see this. I think Lynn White is wrong about this. I do not think we see this to any great degree in the history of ancient Israel. The Hebrews did not brutalize nature more so than other peoples because they recognized that God exists in addition to nature and beyond nature, because they recognized that nature was the gift of God, and they saw themselves as not just those who could manipulate and exploit nature, but those called to be stewards. And remember, I mentioned now already a couple of times, but I'll repeat it because it is such a fundamentally important observation. The whole theme in Genesis of humans exercising dominion over nature, I would suggest in the first instance, is not a moral imperative, but an empirical observation. To be human means you have power over nature. As I put it, once the forebrain gets as powerful as it is, once we're capable of language and mathematics and the kind of abstract thinking, once we are able to be self-reflexive and ask how ought we to live and so on, humans will, in a sense, dominate nature. This is a concern, a realization that is thousands of years old. We'll talk a little later about some of the ancient myths that talk about the latent fears that humans had when they began to control fire and metals and weapons of war. So humans will, in a certain sense, control and dominate nature. The only interesting question, I think, ethically, is how do we do it? Do we do it in a way that recognizes the intrinsic value of nature, the beauty, the wonder, the sense of awe that nature inspires? Do we do it in recognition of the rights and interests of other creatures? Do we do it in a way that reflects a kind of fundamental humility, that we ought not to go around vandalizing what we didn't create in the first place? Or will we do it in the way, tragically, which we all too often have done, looking just to our own narrow, short-term interests? So the desacralizing of nature does not inevitably lead to the brutalizing of nature, but it makes it more nearly a possibility or a likelihood. Some of the older constraints, I think, were removed. But on the whole, the Jewish scriptures reflect a very positive view of both man and nature. I've already commented on the passage in Genesis, the creation story in Genesis 1, where every few verses as God creates different things, it says, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then in the 31st verse, the last verse of the chapter, and God beheld everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good, pointing to a kind of intrinsic value that was seen already in ancient times for nature. So that desacralized nature can also be nature that has intrinsic or inherent value, or to put it more accurately, theologically, for the ancient Israelites, God valued nature for its own sake and not just because it was of instrumental or consequentialist value for humans. There's a tendency today, I think without question, to romanticize nature and especially wilderness. And I think that's because at our worst we reflect a kind of shallow contemporaneity and do not know in much detail the enormous pressures that humans have felt over the millennia and even a few centuries ago to survive. Can you imagine what it was like in New England with all the rocks and everything to clear even an acre of beech maple or oak forest? Men would get hernias, not any possibility of modern surgery. People, just to clear the land, just to survive, just to be able to plant some meager crops was a Herculean effort. Take an afternoon, a Saturday afternoon perhaps, drive around Ithaca, and this area was settled only, the earliest settlers, what, roughly 200 years ago. Look at some of the cemetery markers. Look at the incredible number of young women who died in childbirth. Look at the number of children who did not get beyond their first year or their fourth or fifth year. I'm old enough to remember back in the 30s. You went back to school in the fall, and there might be one or two kids who had gotten polio. Maybe someone died of scarlet fever or something. There weren't antibiotics. They were just beginning to use sulfa in the late 30s. It was a different world. And I think before we today become too judgmental about what our forebears did, we need to have some historical imagination. We need to have some realistic sense of how tough it was to survive. The Black Death wiped out whole populations or large parts of them in Europe in the Middle Ages. Areas that had been cultivated field went back to forest. People worried about underpopulation. Oh, incidentally, just as a footnote, one of you, I think it was in this class, not my other one, one of you was troubled by the fact that I pointed to underpopulation as a problem. Was that in this class that I mentioned that, the birth rate in Spain and Italy and so on? And what I had in mind was something like this. I think the aggregate population of the world is still a concern, and it obviously can't keep growing forever. But what has happened is, as I noted, that in virtually every developed country, the birth rates are way, way, way below replacement level. You need 2.1 to stay even. In Spain, it's a little over 1.1. In Italy, maybe 1.2. Every European country, and I think even in the U.S. we're under 2.1, although a little higher than we were, is below replacement level. And that portends some very, very serious problems for the future. If the pyramid begins to look like this, with the young people here and the old people here, Who pays for the medical care? Who gives the medical care? Will the society have to have levels of immigration that are so rapid that the whole culture changes quickly and is in turmoil and so on? That's what I had in mind when I pointed to the fact that I think ethically we need to disaggregate the population figures and not see them just as a constant, because there now is great concern in Italy, Spain, Germany, some of these countries, Russia. They're trying to work out incentives to get women to have more babies. And it's particularly acute among the intelligentsia and people who have been economically more successful. Their birth rates are even lower. And that's not just even in the West. That's also among the wealthy in India, and it's clearly true in Japan and so on. That end of footnote. I just wanted to... I'm not saying that issue isn't debatable. You might argue that it's a good thing that even in Europe the trends are downward, but at least it's not an absurd position to take because of the internal disruptions that might produce. Back on track here. I think we need to exercise more historical imagination. If I take off my glasses, life is really grim in some ways. Some ways it's not so grim. It's like an impressionist painting, and I look out over you and I get this wonderful sea of color and sort of shimmering, but not so good for some things. You wouldn't want me driving a car. It's hard enough to drive across campus even with good eyesight, but we have to realize that this wasn't all the greatest. When you believed, as most early cultures did, that every tree and river and mountain and valley, everything was possessed with divinity and had a spirit, life was very confusing. I mean, you had to propitiate all these spirits and make sure you didn't get them irritated and do the right sacrifices. It was complicated. Complicated enough today to keep track of whether you should take vitamins or not and which ones. But can you imagine how complicated when you had all these angry spirits to deal with if you didn't live just right? There's an enormous amount of romanticizing about how great primitive life was. Primitive life, in many respects, was really ugly. Not everywhere. And we've discovered in the last 30, 40 years that there was a great deal of romanticizing among the anthropologists and so on. They wanted it to be pure and simple and elegant. And a lot of the writing really wasn't all that accurate. Because when you're struggling, have a belly full of worms that you live with your whole life, when you've got different diseases and handicaps and famine and malnutrition, life isn't easy, you know? And I mention that simply because I think we have to be more realistic about what nature really is. One of my colleagues, Ray Oglesby, was telling me a few years back, he used to be chairman of our Department of Natural Resources, he was a kind of historian at heart. He loved to read old journals and so on. And he was reading some old journals of some people back a couple hundred years ago when this area was first getting settled, who walked from down around Kingston or Poughkeepsie up towards Ithaca and Syracuse. And he pointed out to me that again and again and again in these journals, there's comments like, oh, this is so boring. When is this going to end? You can't see anything. These damn trees. There's nothing but trees. Couldn't see the sky all that much. You couldn't get any vistas. That's part of nature, too. You know?